This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, this year's Nobel Prize for Physics highlights the potential of quantum computing as the next technological revolution. And we're going to explain it in ways that even I can understand. But now, the Milwaukee Brewers are playing their final game of the season today, but they were already eliminated from playoff contention earlier this week. It's the first time the Brew Crews missed the postseason since 2017. They started the season playing like the best team in the National League Central Division, but since Memorial Day, the Brewers lost more games than they won, and Milwaukee couldn't turn it back around in time to hold a spot in the playoffs. Dominic Catronio is the host of the Brewers Extra Innings postgame show on WTMJ. He also hosts the Locked On Brewers podcast. Dominic, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and let's start with a brief synopsis of the season, where the expectations were when we started, how the season progressed, and how we ended up out of the playoffs.
Yeah, you really alluded to it well, though, that first 50 games, best start in franchise history. You look at the excitement around this team of the new acquisitions. You had Corbin Burns still kicking, firing on all cylinders, being one of the best pitchers in baseball the first month and a half, 2 months of the season. And right around Memorial Day is when things started to shift and that the offense started to get cold, and then they started to deal with injuries. I think one of the first major injuries the Brewers had to deal with was missing Willy Adames for a month. And then they had to deal with Brandon Woodruff getting hurt. And then they had to deal with maybe the biggest blow, Freddy Peralta, missing about 2.5, almost 3 months in the middle of the season of not being able to keep going with a shoulder issue. The good news for the Brewers, though, is that it was never a surgical issue for Freddy. In fact, he's pitched in the last couple of days here in the finale of the season that he's come back healthy. But a big story of the season will be injuries. But perhaps the biggest story of them all was on the trading deadline when the Brewers traded all-star closer Josh Hader for a couple of prospects and two other big league relievers, one of which they immediately released upon acquiring Denelson Lamet, and the other one, Taylor Rogers, who, quite frankly, underperformed in his time here in Milwaukee. So a lot of Brewers fans were really frustrated by the loss of Hader, in addition to the lack of a return, in their opinion. But it's only time will tell about the prospects returned in Este Uri Ruiz and Robert Gasser in that trade. And then the offense went silent, and there were a lot of close games on the stretch that the Brewers were winning in the first half that, quite frankly, didn't turn their way in the second half.
Yeah, and Dom, the story about the Josh Hader trade at the deadline, I believe that was about the last time we caught up with you about the Brewers this season, and that being a turning point as Brewers, many Brewers fans saw it, but it's not like Josh Hader performed that well once he was traded off from the Brewers, did he?
And he wasn't performing well even in the beginning of July. It was the worst month statistically of his entire career. And the Brewers were maybe a little bit worried because we know how the Brewers operate. They're a small market team. They trade stars at their highest return level in order to return prospects. And the quote that David Stearns used that's been repeated over and over and over again is take as many bites at the apple as possible. And for Josh Hader, his first couple of weeks in San Diego were very odd. In fact, for a brief time, he was removed from the closer's role for the Padres. But in the last month and a month and a half or so, he has righted the ship. He is back to normal Josh Hader. And he brings a lot of postseason experience to that ball club that does not have a lot of postseason experience. So the Brewers will certainly have conflicted feelings watching the Padres in the postseason, given they're sitting on their living room couches the rest of this October.
Dominic Catronio is the host of the Brewers Extra Innings postgame show on WTMJ, also hosts the Locked On Brewers podcast. And how hot is Milwaukee Brewers manager Craig Counsell's seat at the end of this season?
I look at it that his seat is room temperature.
Okay.
You know, it didn't change in one way or another. I quite frankly commend Counsell for what he's had to go through this season, like you said, with the injuries, but also the changes. I mean, that's a lot to weigh on a clubhouse. And not only Josh Hader is a big, you know, departure from this team in trades, you also have to look back to late May when the Brewers officially designated for assignment Lorenzo Cain. Not only a fan favorite and a legendary Brewer on some great playoff teams, he was a clubhouse favorite, a clubhouse leader, a veteran. And that impacted the clubhouse, but they felt like they could withstand that. And he was always going to be a fan from afar. It was a mutual classy move by the Brewers to do to release him after he achieved 10 years of service time, which basically means he's able to max out his Major League Baseball pension. It was a very classy thing to do, but to have two major blows of chemistry in your clubhouse, it's so hard to quantify, obviously, for right. Nerds like me, but the point is, chemistry is a real thing, and a lot of players have alluded to it all season. Something's been off the entire second half, and it's very easy to point at the Josh Hader trade.
So then, Dom, I have to ask, how hot is the seat for the front office of the Milwaukee Brewers?
I think for the first time in a long time, it's a step above room temperature. I'm not ready to say, oh, David Stearns and Matt Arnold are on the hot seat. Maybe, you know, we have to let this play out. But one bad trade as it looks in 2 months, maybe won't look like a bad trade in 2 years. So I think this is going to be a very important offseason, though, for David Stearns and company, because it's clear this team needs some offense. There will be some key departures coming up, like Colton Wong is not expected to be returning to the team under a team option. You'll also have to replace maybe Omar Narvaez. You'll have to figure out what you're doing at third base. So there are some question marks still on this team to figure out what are you going to do in 2023 to make them better and get back into the postseason.
Is the window closing for opportunities to make it all the way back to the series at some point for the Milwaukee Brewers? Is rebuilding on the horizon? What's next for this team?
That's why this offseason is so important, because you are nearing that crossroads. For those who don't know, the arbitration process generally takes 3 years, the last 3 years of a player's time in the big leagues before he hits free agency. So right now, heading into this offseason, it'll be the second year for Brandon Woodruff, for Corbin Burnes, for Devin Williams, for Willy Adames, the main core, Rowdy Tellez. Hunter Renfro will be heading into his third year of arbitration, meaning after next season, he will be a free agent. So it's easy to say, yes, the window is closing, but at the same time, there is an opportunity to maybe extend Corbin Burnes or Brandon Woodruff to send out a signal to the rest of the league and the rest of this clubhouse saying, no, we're not going to a rebuild. David Stearns has made that clear. They do not intend on rebuilding. And that's where the as many bites out of the apple comes from. And it's amazing that the floor has risen to this level of saying they expect to make the postseason every single year, which I know a lot of Brewers fans here in Milwaukee for years and years and years know that wasn't always the case back in the 90s and the early 2000s. So it is refreshing to have urgency and to have a team that should be able to be make it to the World Series, because pitching is always what carries you. So there is a little bit of urgency this offseason to figure out that is this window going to be extended, or are you going to go full on youth movement for 23 and 24?
Dominic, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.
Dominic Cotroneo is the host of the Brewers Extra Innings postgame show on WTMJ, also hosting the Locked On Brewers podcast. With us today, looking at how the Milwaukee Brewers missed the playoffs this season and where it leaves the franchise going forward. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Maureen McCollum with a name origin for a corner of the state.
As people enter the Driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin, they're transported from a relatively flat region to a sudden maze of rolling hills. Roads wind up the sides of bluffs and then back down to the valleys below. Its beauty is without question. But where does the name Driftless come from? That's a question sent to WPR's Wisconsin Project. WPR's Jonah Balekas hit the winding roads to find the answer for us.
Water flows through a stream in the Kickapoo Valley Reserve in Vernon County. Sandstone and limestone rock appear on a bluffside with white pine and yellow birch trees. I'm off a hiking trail after wading through wildflowers and other native plant life. While living in Madison, Claire Holland scratched her itch to explore by driving west through the bluffs and valleys of the Driftless area. She asked Wisconsin where the name came from. I spoke with Colin Belby, professor and head of the Geography and Earth Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He explains that driftless means the absence of glacial drift, hence driftless. If glaciers had passed through this part of the state, they would have left behind rock material that geologists could connect to other regions.
If you drive around to many parts of Wisconsin, you'll find, for instance, crystalline rocks. They're rocks that come from northern Wisconsin or even up into Canada that don't match the local sedimentary rock types that are maybe found in the southern part of Wisconsin or the southeastern part of Wisconsin. Well, so southwest Wisconsin has evidence of glacial drift, glacial erratics, or glacially deposited sediments on all sides of it. But there is no evidence of these glacial deposits within the Driftless area.
So, what is the Driftless area like? Back by the stream at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and surrounded by chirping birds, I meet with Marcy West on a sunny afternoon. She's a member of the state's Natural Resources Board and ran the reserve for 24 years.
By my definition, it just feels very untouched, like we can see the hills and valleys and get into it, explore it, really look at the diversity of the plants and the birds and just enjoy the quiet and solitude in some areas like this.
As she's a stone's throw away from the Kickapoo River, West says the river is by far her favorite part of the Driftless area, especially when she's kayaking.
It just is such a gorgeous trip and an incredible way to see, again, those beautiful rock outcroppings and the huge pine trees and hemlocks hanging on to the rock outcroppings with the root systems, clear water, trout fishing, just the quiet and being able to see a variety of mosses and plants and birds in every season is definitely my favorite.
Belby, the UWL professor, also appreciates the area's diversity.
We have caves here. We have the big river, the Mississippi River. We have small streams. We have medium streams. It's just a really kind of diverse physical landscape that results in a very diverse kind of biological landscape. And also, I think, results in a very diverse cultural landscape. I think all those things are really, really tied together.
Whether it's the Baraboo Range with hills that cover thousands of acres in Sauk and Columbia counties, or the Mississippi River that separates Wisconsin and Minnesota, or Wildcat Mountain towering over the Kickapoo River in Vernon County, or Perot State Park, found at the confluence of the Mississippi and Trempealeau Rivers, Wisconsinites who have never seen the Driftless area can hop in their cars and chart a path through the southwestern part of the state that the last glaciers never did.
WPR's Jonah Balekas brought us that story on where Wisconsin's Driftless area got its name from. And that story idea came to us from an audience member as part of WPR's Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And coming up, three scientists just won the Nobel Prize in Physics for proving Albert Einstein wrong. Spooky action at a distance explained by a quantum physicist. Next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and three scientists were awarded the Nobel Prize for their work in quantum physics this week, specifically something called quantum entanglement. Let me see if I can explain. Let's say you have two coins, and you flip two coins, and that when one coin is heads, the other coin's always going to be tails, and the other way around as well, no matter what. That's the basic idea of quantum entanglement, as I understand it, except that instead of coins, it's tiny particles like electrons and photons. So let's say now you have one coin, and your friend who lives all the way, oh, I don't know, in Ohio has another one. If these coins are quantum entangled, the distance between them doesn't matter. When you flip your coin, one side will be heads, and the other will be tails. But this gets crazier still. If you decide to change the result without telling your friend all the way over there in Ohio, say you got heads, then changed it to tails, well, your friend's coin over in Ohio will still be the opposite. How does that work? Of course, this doesn't happen with coin flips, but it does evidently happen with subatomic particles. So here to help us understand it all is Shimon Kolkowitz, Associate Professor of Physics at UW-Madison. He's an experimental quantum scientist who studies practical applications of quantum mechanics. Shimon, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Lee. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and how would you explain quantum entanglement briefly now that it's been at least acknowledged by the Nobel Prize?
Yeah, well, I think you did a great job, actually. You know, basically, the idea is that in quantum mechanics, which, as you said, governs things on very small scales, things like electrons, atoms, and the quantized units of light that we call photons, sometimes you can have a situation where you can't separate out the states of two different particles. So as you said, if you replace your coins in your analogy with two electrons, you might have two electrons where their states or their positions might actually be fundamentally intertwined such that you can't separate them. You can't talk about them individually anymore. And what that means, as you said, is if you take them and put them in two different places and you start messing around with one, it actually seems to impact the other one instantaneously. And that was something that really bothered Albert Einstein, for example, and he called it spooky action at a distance.
And you could understand why it would confuse Einstein, because everything I knew about his physics comes from high school, and we didn't know any of this. In fact, you had to be close to something in order to have an effect on it, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's a principle called locality. And usually in most areas of physics, we like to think that the physics that we're studying in that you know, of that particular object, say that particle, is only determined by the stuff that it's right around it. And it takes always takes the speed of light for something else to impact it. So the further away you get, you know, the longer it should take for some change over somewhere far away to impact your particle. But in quantum mechanics, that just turns out not to be true. And that's actually what the Nobel Prize was given for, was actually really proving that that's not really how things work in quantum mechanics.
Yeah, and that was my next question, Shimon, is how much of this is theoretical, how much is practical, and how much of this is so brand new that we just don't know exactly what we're dealing with yet?
Well, that's a really great question. So we're really right now at about the 100-year mark for quantum mechanics. So we've understood most of quantum mechanics for about 100 years now. But it's very weird. It's very counterintuitive, even to people who study it every day, like myself. It's just totally different from our everyday experiences. And unfortunately, also, you know, we live in a very, what we call classical. We distinguish between quantum and classical. We live in a classical world. We use language that we've developed as kind of classical beings. And so it's actually pretty hard, as you can tell, even as we try to discuss it, to talk about the effects of quantum physics, you know, because it's not something that we're used to, and it's so counterintuitive. Having said that, you know, what's remarkable is people like Einstein, you know, Einstein was really good at coming up with thought experiments. And he proposed this experiment, exactly like what you said, of taking two particles and pointed out that in quantum mechanics, they can be entangled, their states can be intertwined, and putting them on opposite ends of, say, the universe, and then doing this experiment. And he was trying to say, this can't be right. There must be something wrong with quantum mechanics. It must not be complete. That was basically his argument. And John Stuart Bell, who was a scientist at CERN in Europe, actually, but who happened to be visiting the University of Wisconsin on a kind of sabbatical when he wrote this paper, wrote a paper in 1964 showing mathematically that if you assume that that quantum mechanics is missing something, you'll get a fundamentally different answer from doing certain kinds of experiments, kind of like the coin flipping experiments you were describing, than you would if quantum mechanics is correct. And even then, people thought, including Bell, this was kind of just an abstraction. It was a sort of a mathematical way to try to think about the different formulations and understand these things. But then the three scientists who just won the Nobel Prize, starting with John Clauser, working with a grad student, Stuart Friedman, in 1972, actually did the experiments. And sure enough, they showed that the results are consistent with quantum mechanics and not with any other theory, not with any theory where quantum mechanics is somehow missing something or where locality is preserved. So it's really reality, believe it or not.
Which is hard to believe when you've developed a Cartesian map of the world and you have time and space as Einstein linked the two. But now you've got spooky action at a distance, as Einstein called it. So what are the practical applications here, Shimon Kolkowitz? And let's start with what you're working on.
Oh, well, yeah, thanks a lot. So there are real practical applications. And, you know, what I work on is something called quantum sensing. We're trying to use these quantum systems and these kinds of effects like entanglement, superposition, the idea that particles can be in two different states or two different places at the same time to make really sensitive and precise measurement devices. Things like clocks, which I work on, turn out to be surprisingly important. For example, some of your listeners may or may not know that the GPS network, the way that you get instructions on your phone, actually relies on very precise atomic clocks, which are already a kind of quantum technology. We're trying to use some of these even stranger aspects of quantum mechanics, like entanglement, to make clocks even better. And I will say that when people did these original experiments, people like Clauser and Elena Spee and Anton Zeilinger, they initially were just trying to answer questions about the universe. But now part of the reason why I think they're being recognized for the Nobel Prize is we're on the verge of all of these new technologies based off of these discoveries mm-hmm. and based off of these techniques. So things that people thought were really esoteric and academic and almost thought experiments have now turned into technological realities that are starting to change the world.
Technological realities. Shimon Kolkowitz, as it starts to change the world, how could this change for me? What would what could we see in our lifetimes that would be the revolutionary technology that we have yet to even imagine?
Well, that's a hard question to you know, prognosticate mm-hmm. or answer. I mean, there's a lot of different things. So quantum technologies like quantum computers that can solve problems that all the computers we have currently, they don't really exist yet, but they're on the verge of becoming a reality. We think they could help with things like drug development, with developing new materials with properties that we can't even predict or haven't thought of yet. The kinds of sensors that I work on can help with autonomous vehicles, navigation, even with things like maybe predicting whether a volcano is going to erupt. So there is a huge range of different areas where these technologies will start to have an impact, and in some cases are already starting to have impact.
Yeah, so how does it move from theoretical to practical? What's that, and from your perspective, Shimon, what's that look like?
Well, it looks like doing experiments in labs, the kinds of experiments that these three scientists were awarded the Nobel Prize for, but also the kind of experiments that are happening in my lab and in a lot of other labs at the University of Wisconsin and a lot of other research institutions, of course. But I should say that the University of Wisconsin is actually a very special place. There's a lot of quantum science research going on here and a lot of these different technologies that we're talking about. And the other thing is that there's a lot of people doing that research. There's graduate students and undergraduates and postdoctoral researchers and faculty that are all involved in this work. And some of these scientists who just won the Nobel Prize, like Alain Aspé, for example, he won for his graduate research. So I just like to encourage all of your listeners, and especially people who are interested in science, that, you know, you can all really get involved. And it's people who are doing this.
And maybe you someday, too, can prove Albert Einstein wrong.
Well, actually, we're using these clocks to test relativity. And so we recently did a measurement where we proved him right about something. Einstein was right about a lot of things, right, but he was just wrong about a few things.
Well, he just could not understand. What was his saying? Something about God doesn't roll the dice or something like that?
Yeah, that's right. He famously said God doesn't play with dice because he was really bothered about the fact that quantum mechanics is fundamentally random or non-deterministic. There's a story that Niels Bohr, one of the other sort of founders of quantum mechanics, famously told Einstein in response, don't tell God what to do.
Shimon, we're out of time, but I thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks a lot. It was my pleasure.
Shimon Kolkowitz, Associate Professor of Physics at UW-Madison, where the quantum physics are happening. He's an experimental quantum scientist who studies practical applications of quantum mechanics, and he talked to us about the science behind the most recent Nobel Prize in Physics. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Today you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, new numbers from the DNR show Wisconsin's wolf population went down following last year's controversial hunt, but the agency says it remains stable, and we'll talk with a biologist about the data and what they mean for how we manage gray wolves in the state. But first, our Wisconsin CEO series continues with Sargento Foods, a name you must recognize from the grocery store. Now, Sargento is a cheese manufacturer that's known for its shredded and pre-sliced cheeses and cheese snacks. They have over 2,000 employees, $1.5 billion in revenue, and they've been based in Plymouth, Wisconsin since the early 1950s. Louis Gentine is the CEO of Sargento and the third generation of family ownership. Louis, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, tell us a little bit briefly about the Sargento story and how it's lasted in Wisconsin for now almost 70 years.
Yeah, so my grandfather moved from the Milwaukee area up to Plymouth, Wisconsin, the cheese capital of the world, actually to start a Catholic funeral home in the town. And that lasted for probably about 10 to 15 years, and he started actually making gift boxes of cheeses collected from the more than 100 different cheese manufacturers in Sheboygan County. And he would send those down to his friends, family, business associates down in Milwaukee. And then, as mentioned, in the early 1950s, 1953, he partnered with Joe Sartori. The Sar from Sartori, the Gent for Gentine, and the O was added to make us sound Italian because the first consumer varieties of cheese that we packaged were Italian style. So mozzarella, provolone, Parmesan, Romano, those types of things. And from there, it's just been a great success of innovation and building a culture of hiring good people and treating them like family that has allowed us to create value for not only our employees, but our communities and all of our stakeholders.
So, Louis, you're the CEO of Sargento now, but how did it start for you? Tell us a little bit about your experience with the company.
So my experience when I was a child was really nothing more than having an opportunity to taste our new products when my dad would bring them home and bring them to the dinner table. Or he would show us the latest and greatest advertising that Sargento did. Then when I was a teenager, my first job at Sargento was actually washing semi-trucks. And I had done that for about 4 or 5 years. had an opportunity then to work on our frozen breaded appetizer line in Elkhart Lake at the time, where we made like breaded cheese sticks that went to national chain restaurants across the United States. Spent some time in our sales team over the summer. And then after about 3 years working in commercial banking in Chicago, I came back to Sargento in 2000 and have had the opportunity to be in our marketing team, our production team, procurement, running our retail business unit. And then when my dad retired in 2013, actually just about 9 years ago, I moved into the CEO spot.
So Louis Sargento has been a big player in the dairy industry for decades. You have seen any number of different facets of Sargento's business, and now you are the chief executive officer. We've covered the story of dairy farmers struggling in Wisconsin. What's it been like for you to see their struggles in the recent years?
Well, I think it's definitely something that, you know, no one wants to see that. You know, everybody wants to be able to see, you know, really everybody within the supply chain, you know, doing well and being able to provide for their family. You know, certainly with the variety of different cost increases that have occurred, you know, throughout the number of years, it has been a challenge. You know, the farmers are pretty resilient and, you know, always figure out a way to kind of work through those times and then capitalize on the times that, you know, are good. When milk prices are high, you know, that tends to be a good thing for the dairy farmers as well. Unfortunately, there's a fair amount of volatility that really everybody within the supply chain has to manage, and it's different really for everybody else, for everyone.
Louis Gentine, CEO of Sargento Foods, our guest. And Louis, how do small dairy farms shuttering their doors, the consolidation of dairy farming in recent memory, how has that affected the business?
Well, you know, thankfully the overall milk supply continues to increase, and you know, it is hard to see smaller farms kind of close the doors, you might say. You know, and many times it often is that there's not, you know, kind of a next generation who's willing to put in the amount of work that's required to be a dairyman or be a dairy farmer. You know, as you know, the cow never stops needing to be milked. So it truly is a 24/7, 365 day operation. And, you know, as, you know, some of the smaller farms have kind of closed up or have pivoted to do just maybe more cash cropping as opposed to being a dairy farmer, you know, certainly other farms have been willing to take on additional cows to produce more milk and ultimately supply what is still a very healthy and growing industry, that being the dairy industry.
Louis, how did the pandemic affect operations for Sargento? How did you pivot and how did you adapt?
Well, maybe the question is, how did it not affect our operations? It was very challenging. You know, certainly we were operating and running, you know, through the entire pandemic. I give our suppliers, our employees, a whole lot of credit for the amount of work and effort that they put into allowing us to be able to still supply our customers and consumers, you know, across the United States. It was tough. You know, certainly there's new protocols and new things that we had to do in order to keep our employees safe, which by far was our number one priority. And I think looking back at it, the flexibility and adaptability of our Sargento family really was the big reason of why we were able to pull through.
Yeah. Did you see any changes in consumer behavior, or did what cheese eaters want change over the pandemic?
Yeah, there was a dramatic changes, you know, certainly in the food service industry from a restaurant standpoint, even though, you know, people were kind of doing pickup, you know, often that industry was really struggled. The offset to that, however, was, you know, a lot of people were eating more at home. And, you know, to this date, you know, we still, if you kind of look at it, a share of some stomach of what's eaten at home pre-pandemic versus now versus out of home, the consumers, I think, have appreciated really the benefits of eating more at home, eating more with home with their family, and allowing people to kind of connect and have those conversations, which, you know, it was a bad time, the pandemic, but I think that to me is one of those opportunities that consumers and everybody saw, is the power of bringing people together. And certainly food, and I would say cheese, does a pretty good job of bringing people together.
Louis Gentine, the CEO of Sargento Foods, our guest. It's based in Plymouth. And Louis, in the news recently, Sargento Foods acquired Baker Cheese Factory. Tell us what that will add to the company.
Yeah, well, the Baker Cheese has been around for many generations. And what they bring to Sargento is just an exceptional high quality string cheese. So we're very excited to welcome more than 250 members of the Baker Cheese family to the Sargento family, and looking to continue to grow and leverage their capabilities and their great cheese making history in the innovations that we bring to the marketplace in the future.
So what do you see next for Sargento over the next few years, Louis?
Well, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise to really any of your listeners. We're going to continue focusing on bringing innovative ideas to the consumer. And, you know, some of our more recent innovations are Balance Breaks, which is a snack that, you know, provides a healthy, wholesome snack for consumers. We got a great pipeline of innovation in our snacking portfolio. But I would say we have a few other good things up our sleeves as well.
Louis, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. You've made me hungry.
Well, thank you for having me.
Louis Gentine, he's the CEO of Sargento Foods, a cheese manufacturer based in Plymouth. He was with us today for our Wisconsin CEO series, where we talk to leaders from some of the state's biggest companies. Coming up, we'll hear about new data on the state's gray wolf population and what they could mean for wolf management in the future. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and the State Department of Natural Resources is out with new data showing the state's gray wolf population declined by 14% following a controversial hunting season in February of last year. That hunt, which killed more than 200 wolves over 3 days, surpassed the quota set by the state. And after a federal court ruling this year, wolves are now protected once again at the federal level. The state says between 812 and 1,193 wolves are in Wisconsin, pointing to 972 is that most likely estimate. And biologists in the agency say that while the population is smaller than it was before the hunt, it's still stable. Our next guest questions those numbers and is with us to talk about the data and where the wolf population in Wisconsin goes from here. Adrian Trevis is a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison, and he's also the co-founder of the school's Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Afternoon, Lee. Happy to be here.
Before we get into the new population data, let's talk about the aftermath of last year's wolf hunt, where hunters killed 218 wolves. After that, what questions were biologists and researchers like yourself curious about to figure out how the wolf population would respond?
Well, it was an unprecedented hunt in many regards. The methods that were used, the timing during the pregnancy and mating season of the wolves, the heavy snow cover we had on the ground, and some of those methods are unstudied scientifically. So a lot of questions about the reported and unreported death toll of wolves. Also questions about how the state was estimating mortality at the baseline and mortality after the hunt. Lots of questions about illegal killing. And then scientists were also asking questions about the sustainability of future hunting seasons, which led into the events of the fall of 2021, as you may be aware, where the Natural Resource Board and the Department of Natural Resources locked horns very publicly in August of 2021 over the quota setting exercise. And then, as your listeners may be aware, state court weighed in and blocked the sale of wolf tags for a second wolf hunt in 2021. So lots of questions all around.
Yeah, and some of those questions have to do with the DNR's own estimates, Adrian. I understand that's due in part to the range for wolf packs and how it figures into the state's model. It was detailed by Danielle Kading in WPR News last week, but could you explain your concern there?
Yeah, sure. First, let me say, Lee, that it's an incredibly difficult task to count wolves from the first place, and to count them across a whole state makes it all the more difficult. So my hat's off to all of the volunteers, a raft of volunteers who help the DNR with this count, the on-the-ground biologists who are conducting those winter track surveys and howling surveys. Those are not easy jobs, and it's a very difficult and time-consuming task, not to mention the next step, which is what does one do with the numbers detected on the ground using these winter track surveys. So in collaboration with a number of other researchers, I'm now in discussions with Dr. Scott Creel out of Montana State University, who has published his concerns over his own state's use of an occupancy model. It's a different occupancy model than used in Wisconsin, but some of the concerns are the same. So he and I and about a half dozen other scientists around the country and even around the world are sharing our concerns with governments, with other scientists about the risk of overestimating wolf populations by using occupancy models.
Are there concerns about underestimating populations?
Currently, no, because the states that are using these, Montana and Wisconsin, are making assumptions that lead to overestimation bias. In science, we refer to bias as, in a statistical sense, as inaccuracies or imprecisions that are consistently in one direction or another. So in this case, the scientific concerns are about positive bias or overestimation bias, that the numbers of wolves being reported are an overestimate of the actual number on the ground, simply because the assumptions the DNR has made are always in that direction towards estimating more wolves than might actually be there.
The DNR says it's confident in its numbers and that their model's been used in peer-reviewed journals. Some biologists outside the agency have also said the numbers sound good to them. Our guest, Adrian Trevis, is a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison and the founder of the school's Carnivore Coexistence Lab. And how significantly, Adrian, do you think the state's estimate is really off here?
Well, I can't even hazard a guess because they're not sharing those raw data from the volunteers and the biologists' counts on the ground. So until they share those data with the independent scientific community, there's no way to verify or replicate the estimate that they've presented to the public and to the Natural Resource Board. And that's actually one of the problems, that these methods are a kind of a black box. So your listeners should know that there is a peer-reviewed article out there. It's referred to as Stauffer et al. 2021. It's a peer-reviewed paper, but it does not take us from volunteer counts all the way to the state wolf population estimate. What it does is it does a simulation of the occupancy model being used, and it tells its readers what the best set of assumptions is for that occupancy model. But then on top of it, the DNR has added layers, like adding extra sauce to a sandwich. And the layers they're adding are new assumptions about how to handle the winter track survey data coming from their volunteers. And I know this is a little bit in the weeds, a little bit technical for your audience, but there are models, and then there are how you handle the models. And most of our concerns are with how the DNR has handled the model they were given by Stauffer et al.
And to be clear, Adrian, why are these numbers so important to Wisconsin?
Well, realistically, the number of wolf packs is biologically the more important number. And I want to give credit to the DNR for actually trying to make that point in the Natural Resource Board meeting last week. However, our policies and to some extent our leadership is fixated on the number of wolves, which is not a good indicator of the health and the sustainability or the security of our wolf population. Because wolf packs are like families or like teams, and there's only one breeding pair in a wolf pack, it's actually the number of wolf packs that gives us an indication of how healthy a wolf population is and how able it is to withstand hunting, like we saw in February 2021.
Adrian, I want to get your reaction to a quote from a Natural Resources Board member, Bill Bruins, from Daniel Kading's story last week. While the wolf hunt we know last year surpassed the quota set by the DNR, a lot of people in conservation agree that it got a little out of control. However, after this new data was reported, the Natural Resources Board member, Bill Bruins, said, and I'm quoting from the story here, the sky didn't entirely fall with that February hunt. What was your reaction to that? What's the context of that?
Well, it's a real folksy way of describing the situation, isn't it? You know, everyone can agree or anyone can disagree with it, depending on how you define the sky falling. If there had been a second hunt, our models and simulations indicate that we would have passed some legal thresholds that the Wisconsin public has repeatedly opposed, such as dropping below the 1999 Wisconsin wolf population target, our goal of 350 wolves, or possibly even falling below 250, which is the statutory listing level, had there been a second wolf hunt in November 2021. So I take the comment by Mr. Bruins of the Natural Resource Board to indicate that we don't have an all-out train wreck or dumpster fire on our hands. But that doesn't mean we can sit back and be complacent, or that scientists like myself need to turn off our skepticism when the DNR presents numbers that are not scientifically defendable.
Adrian, as mentioned before, a federal court ruling in February of this year has protected wolves once again. If that protection stays in place, what do you think will happen with the wolf population over the next year or so in Wisconsin?
Well, the legal methods that the state has used in the past to kill wolves are no longer legal because of federal protections. The tribes are carefully watching what the federal government does, and if the wolves are delisted again, the tribes will continue watching what the state government does, because the wolf is revered in Ojibwe tradition and many other tribes' traditions. Also, the environmental community in general is deeply concerned about anti-wolf sentiment in wildlife agencies around the country. So there are watchdog groups making sure that we don't see a repeat of the February 2021 wolf hunt or a repeat of the eradication campaigns of the past.
And finally, Adrian, just are there points of the arguments for advocates for wolf hunting in Wisconsin that you understand or can come to terms with? Is there something from the other side that you can appreciate?
Oh, sure. I mean, Lee, part of your question there is about different human values. Yeah. And, I'm a scientist. I weigh evidence and I try to discuss the evidence. But there's a long tradition in our country of allowing a minority of people to hunt wildlife in the legal fashion using legal methods. In my opinion, it's a little bit out of hand. The February 2021 wolf hunt got out of hand, and that's actually violating the public trust, which is an 1842, ever since 1842, a legal doctrine that says that wildlife belong to all of the public and future generations, not just to hunters. So I appreciate that question, Lee.
Adrian, I appreciate you joining us this afternoon. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. My pleasure.
Adrian Trevis is a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about his concerns with new wolf population numbers from the state DNR. Now, the agency says it stands by their latest estimate of 972 wolves in the state and that the wolf population is healthy and biologically secure.